Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies. Movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The podcast, though, well, we're here to talk off the stories of film, the production stories, development stories, behind the scenes, bits and bobs, all those little contributory parts that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. I'm rounding off 2019's episode of Film Stories with one more special. And so shortly I'm going to play you my conversation with the director Dexter Fletcher, where we talk about Rocket Man, where we talk about Sunshine on Leith, where we talk about Eddie the Eagle. We talk about all sorts of things, really. But I did want to front load this particular episode of Film Stories and just really to say thank you for the incredible support you've all given me over the course of the last 12 months. This is my first full year of podcasting. I think we've put out 60 podcasts this year, and the support that I've received has just been hugely, hugely, hugely appreciated. Likewise, the support of the magazines Film Stories and Film Stories Junior, which you can get at filmstories.co.uk if you want as well. None of this could really keep going without the support of the people who've listened, who've encouraged me, who've really just had my back throughout what's been a bit of a testing year. So an enormous thanks to you. Thanks to the people who support this podcast and support me on Patreon at patreon.com/Simon Brew. In 2020, the plan is to release some of the podcasts a little bit earlier to Patreon subscribers, but I'm still also absolutely adamant that these podcasts should be available free of charge, and they'll continue as a consequence to be available free of charge. Anyway, lots and lots of waffle from me. So let's get on to the business of the day, which is a prolonged conversation with director Dexter Fletcher. Now, just in terms of setting the scene for this, Dexter Fletcher mentions Matthew Vaughn, of course, of our conversation. Now, Matthew Vaughn, of course, is the director of films like Kingsman, Stardust, X-Men First Class. He's also a producer and co-runs Marv Films, and it's under the stewardship of Marv Films that Rocket Man and Eddie the Eagle and previous Dexter Fletcher movies have been released. So when he starts talking about Matthew Vaughn, it's Matthew Vaughn in his producer capacity. Anyway, I'm going to play you a clip from Rocket Man, which is a film that we're primarily talking about. It's the first time I've done a film a second time on the podcast, but hopefully you'll agree that the conversation is very much worth it. Here's the clip. I'll pick up the chat the other side of this.
If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man makes potions and travel, sure. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, yeah.
That was a clip from Rocket Man, and I'm delighted to be joined by its director, fresh from, what, Los Angeles?
Los Angeles and Costa Rica, actually.
Los Angeles and Costa Rica, whereas I'm from Dudley and Hale's Own. I'm delighted to be joined by Dexter Fletcher. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, I've been in a previous job on loads of training courses, really boring corporate training courses. And the cliche of choice at those training courses, you get some kind of well-paid instructor at the start, and they tell you, what does success look like? That is the given cliche, as I understand it. What does success look like? I'm curious, when you signed up for this film, because there's so many... the scale of it was bigger than anything you'd done. The fact that you had a concurrent release in America and Britain at the same time, I don't think you'd had that before.
No.
And there were so many new things to this, I think, for you. I'm just curious, what was a success to you?
Well, I don't know. When I first started out directing, and I directed Wild Bill, the thing that got me most intrigued was when I showed it to a producer friend of mine, and he said, they're going to let you do this again. And I think by that he meant let you make a film, another film.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to let you make more films, because I think, you know, as difficult as it is to get your first film made, I think it's equally, if not more so, harder to get your second film made.
Yeah.
And because, you know, if you get it wrong and it's a misstep, people are less willing to take a gamble on you. And so what I've endeavoured to do is try and not run before I could walk and build slowly. But I think success can come in sort of different forms, can't it? There's the critical acclaim, which is always good, but I think this is the first real sort of financial success I've had. I mean, Eddie kind of did okay. No one lost millions of dollars or whatever. Not that it cost that much, but this is sort of seems to have had an equal balance of success, if you see what I mean.
If I've got it right as well, it's the first time you've had a film distributed by the same company in the UK and the US.
That's right. Yeah.
It's been joined up in its.
That's right. I think there was a bit. Matthew Vaughan and I definitely felt there was a bit of a disconnect between having Eddie released by two different studios, as it were. Yeah, by Lionsgate and Fox in England and America, respectively. Obviously, because that's two different marketing departments kind of clashing against one another. And I think as the filmmaker, you can kind of feel that maybe could be working against you.
Yeah. I have to ask on Eddie the Eagle, which I'm a huge fan of. Imported the 4K disc of that from the US because it wasn't released on 4K over here.
Was it not?
No. It got Blu-ray and DVD, but I'm kind of high definition there now. Is the cut the same? Is there anything slightly different in the US cut? Because I sat and watched that with my... I know we've gone off topic already.
Yeah.
But I sat and watched that with my kids and we all just swore that it just felt just a tiny bit different.
I wouldn't know if it is, to be quite honest. I mean, I'd be surprised if it is, because I never authorised any different cut for different regions. So, no, as far as I'm aware. But maybe on second viewing,
I'll forensically go and check that.
Well, you can forensically check it frame by frame. That'd be interested to know.
I'll report that.
Okay, yeah. You know.
I covered Rocket Man in the build-up to its release.
Yeah.
And there was a press day that took place about 2-3 months before, when not a shred of footage had been seen from the film, which was unusual at that point.
Yeah.
And there was chatter in the journalist's room. How well this reflects on the journalists, I don't know.
Yeah.
That the film was in trouble. That's why we weren't being shown.
With Rocket Man. At
that point. Yeah, with Rocket Man.
Oh.
That the film, that there was some kind of problem. Also,
great.
But that was the whisper that was going around when so little of it had been seen that early. I'm just curious, at that point, so that would have been March 2019. And I remember that Taron came in and did interviews and hadn't seen any of the film. Richard Madden came in, hadn't seen any of the film. Jamie. So where was it then? Where was it at that point? Because presumably you were just finishing it.
I was, and I didn't get it finished until a week before Cannes, actually. So I didn't QC it until a week before Cannes. I think it was locked deep in an edit. And I'd put together, I'd done my director's cut, my 10 weeks that you're given, you know. I And I'd done that and obviously shown it to the powers that be, you know, the studio guys all flew over and watched it and said, yes, it's too long, as I knew they would.
Yeah.
And so there was stuff that I was going back and pulling apart. But I think maybe at that point we'd done some pickups as well. And that there was issues around that. I mean, I think where that comes from, because the main body of the film was in good shape, quite honestly, and we didn't really do any pickups in the middle of it. It was the ending that was the issue.
Interesting.
And so there was another ending shot that I was editing it together that ultimately didn't work, that we took the huge and painful decision to throw out and then create the ending that we got, which is not no small part in thanks to Matthew Vaughan,
yeah,
who was instrumental in saying this is how we fix it. And then I took that idea and ran with it. I mean, this is the great thing about having someone like Matthew as the producer, is that not only is he an incredibly accomplished producer, yeah, but as a director he's got a fairly smart eye as well. So that might have been that I might well have been navigating my way through that new ending.
Because you changed your ending on Sunshine on Leith as well, didn't you? That's on the original, the much smaller scale one.
Yeah.
It's on the Blu-ray.
Is it? Yes, I suppose it would be. Yeah.
I think you said there were just people who were there on the day
that
you recruited in.
Yeah, yeah. And I shot different crowds of people as we went through the filming. I had like Jason Fleming and a bunch of people and, yeah, all different. The idea wasn't big enough, I know, because we watched it and I was like, we've got to have a big ending, bigger ending. Yeah. So we did, we went and shot that big ending to Sunshine. And I think that was the kind of train of thought as well with Rocket, because Rocket Man ended with him going through the doors and into the bright light. It was circular in that way. That's where it started, that's where it ended. But it was felt that we could do a bigger ending. Which we did, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
And so... I said, it doesn't work. And then everyone went, you're right, it doesn't work. And
so was it kind of like an inverse situation that the ending needed to be smaller in this case?
No.
It's still quite a...
It is quite a celebratory.
Yeah,
I think it wasn't about scale. It was about euphoria and celebratory. I mean, the film needs to end. I was very adamant it needed to end on a positive up note so that we know that Elton steps into the next phase of his life as a happier person.
Yes.
And brilliantly, Matthew said, what we do is we take the video and we put Taron in where Elton was. And that was a very simple phrase, but it works very well. But I did have another version where he was at a concert walking on hands and you know, it was far more elaborate and expensive. But it just didn't work because it felt forced, whereas this felt a very natural connection between the fantasy of the film and the reality that it was really actually based in.
So have you come up against a film before, have you worked on a film before where the release date has been that set in stone, that you're making that decision to change the ending, what, 2-3 months before, including some fairly sophisticated digital work by the sounds of it, but you've got an immovable wall.
We had an immovable wall. I mean, it was part and parcel of the plan, was why we had to get going as quick as we did, because the nature of Elton's diary was... You got this amount of time until May when Elton will be at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
And that's your release. And the studio said that, and David, you know, slightly with his brow furrowed and his fingers crossed, said...
David Furnish,
Furnish said, look, there's a really great opportunity here because Elton's so busy, you know, and obviously he's a huge part of the marketing.
Yes.
You know, it's massive. You know, it'd be really good to have him there that week and see if we can get to Cannes. We weren't even guaranteed that we were going to be at Cannes.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the bigger issue as well. It's like, okay, let's work towards this release date in May in Cannes. We didn't even know if we'd got into Cannes, even, you know, outside of competition or otherwise. So that was also another huge gamble of it, that we showed it to the powers that be at Cannes, and they went, yes, we will show you there. So... There was a lot riding on it. Now when I think back on it, it was no wonder I was so stressed out.
But so there was a lot riding on it. You're up against this deadline. But does it become the kind of a hostage of circumstance to a degree that because you've got those parameters, you are making those decisions quicker, that there's a lot more instinct to it, that you go with your gut a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that would be the received wisdom. But the truth of it is that... I'm okay with that kind of pressure. I think that, you know, I started learning a phrase on this job, and I kind of live by it now, I suppose, is that you never finish, you just run out of time.
Yeah.
And I think why that's actually probably a good thing is because, given the option, you'd never hand it over.
Yeah.
You could be relentlessly snipping frames and thinking up new ideas and different ways of interpreting songs. And because the film is not based on any original stage musical, it's an original yes. musical in that it's a film. And Sunshine on Leith was based on a stage musical. Yes. So there was lots of time to develop that musical, you know, with workshops and performances and that. But Rocket Man is completely removed from that. It's sort of like all that jazz in that it's just developed for the screen.
Yeah.
And maybe one day it will transfer the other way. But I think what I'm getting at is that it needed some sort of deadlines or parameters, because otherwise, you know, fear and doubt have time to set in, and then you will keep on just playing around with it. And I felt it was probably good, actually, at the end of the day. Although, as tough as it was, people had to work hard, work fast, and get it done. And they'd come to me and say, you know, we're not finished. I'll say, well, you know, you never finish, you just run out of time. So get everything done that we can. So that's what we've worked to.
I mean, I don't want to get into the film that you were working on before, because I think those stories have been everywhere in the press, and they don't need me going in. But what's interesting, I find, is just the sheer pace of this, because I read an interview in Screen that you said basically you had 12 weeks of rehearsal, which you said was a lot of time for a movie, but you were building a musical from scratch in 12 weeks. But how far were you off Bohemian Rhapsody at that point? Was it, you know, Friday you're on one job, Monday you're on the next?
Yeah, I did have to go back and do the pickups and the reshoots for Bohemian Rhapsody
in
the midst of that. And I had to fight to get it to be a weekend so that I could... I think it was 4 days of reshoots. And so I had 2 days I had to take out from rehearsals of Rocket Man in order to be there for the Bohemian Rhapsody pickups. So it was kind of all mixed up and messed together. I mean, I say I had 12 weeks of rehearsals. You know, standard on any film is 12 weeks of prep.
Yeah.
So we had the added extra element of dance and music.
Yes.
And so it was really squeezed. It was really tight, because ordinarily you'd be prepping a film for all the other stuff that you got to do. That was still the same. We still had to do all of that. The design and the shots list and, you know, every other element of the film that you need to do, as well as design those musical numbers and rehearse them and get them, you know, camera ready.
I mean, one contrast I do wonder with Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man is... Is it easier to make a true story about someone who's there, that you can go to much darker places, just by the fact that you can go and ask someone if you can go there and they say yes?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, this is it. You know, my whole thing, aside from the fact Bohemian Rhapsody is a biopic and Rocket Man's a musical.
Yes.
That differentiates them anyway. But in terms of how you tell those stories, you know, Rocket Man, like you say, I can go to Elton and say, look, you're going to sniff a lot of drugs in this part of the film. I need to show the depths of your despair and loneliness. And like you say, he can say, yes, absolutely, you've got to do that. With Freddie, the film is produced and made by people who are protecting his loving memory.
Yes.
And that's a very different place, because Freddie can't do that himself. So it comes from people who loved him. And so maybe their protectiveness comes from somewhere different. And that's why they're very different in terms of how they approach the subject matter.
But in terms of how you approach subject matter as well, that because I felt through your Eddie the Eagle film, you were very protective of Eddie in that film. That there's, I don't think it's much secret that there was a version in development that was quite unpleasant to him.
Yes.
And you came in and made it a really lovely, upbeat, charming film.
Yeah,
but you were going to darker places. I don't know, were you more protective of Eddie than you were of Elton? I mean, was there a contrast in there?
No, I don't think so. I think I made my own decision and choices about that, because, you know, Eddie, the same as Elton, kind of let us get on with it. I mean, you know, with all the best will in the world, Eddie sold his life rights, as they're called,
yes,
and knew that he didn't know anything about filmmaking, and came and spoke with me And when he did, he came there with his two daughters who were kids. And they sat there, and they'd been a long day in London, and they fell asleep on the sofa while he sat there and I talked to him about his life. And I thought, you know, I got to make a film about this guy. Yeah, why would I want to, you know, drag him through being ridiculed when that was what he was kind of subjected to when he'd gone out and become an Olympian? And then what, to make a film about his life and do the same thing to him again? I just felt was kind of immoral in a way. Yeah. And not necessary. You know, you've got people who love him, kids who, his family love him, and I wanted to, and I didn't think it was necessary. I don't make comedies. I'm not.
I do make funny films, though.
I can, I suppose. Yeah, I don't not have a sense of humour, and I like to have, yes, you know, stuff make you laugh. I'm up for that, but I don't make comedies, and the comedy version of it, I'm not the guy to make that. I'm the guy who would endeavour to make a more rounded, hopefully a more rounded version of those stories, and obviously that played into with Elton as well. But Elton was again like, do the film you got to do. Just it's gonna be, you know, blood, sweat, and tears—the snot and tears version, as we call it, rather than the glossy kind of lip gloss version.
How good is the score to Eddie the Eagle, by the way?
It's great.
Never says that, isn't that?
It's
some
really good
piece of work.
Matthew Marsden's great. He does the score for Kingsman as well. He's a great, great composer.
So I saw pictures of you after the Cannes premiere of this film, and I just—it was a man's face as a Venn diagram from what I could see of euphoria and shell shock. And can you encapsulate what that day was and how that felt? And I've just got no idea what it's like to be the human being in the midst of that.
Okay, well, like I said, you know, I QC'd the film on Friday before in London, and then by Thursday I was in Cannes.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to Cannes Film Festival before. And, you know, there's Willem Dafoe and Quentin Tarantino and you know, all these incredible people wandering around. And there I am with a film that nobody has really seen yet, not finished anyway. And Elton John's going to be there, and Bernie Taupin and Julianne Moore's in the audience, and as well as many other luminaries. Yeah. So I was extremely stressful to start with. And you're subjected to this incredible... You know, you've been in an edit suite for the last 6 months, which is a dark room.
There's human beings in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. So there's thousands of human beings with cameras, and you're asked to put on these flash clothes, and you get out there and stand next to Elton, who's used to it, and everyone's just screaming, Elton, Elton, Elton. And so you suddenly find you're in the midst of a complete circus, and you don't know. I mean, you think the film is good, or I hope the film was good, but it was only a few people's opinion that I'd had at that point. And Bernie and Elton hadn't seen the finished thing. And Bernie certainly hadn't, and Elton had kind of purposefully kept himself away from it. So there was all the stress and the kind of uncertainty about that. And then that bubble burst, and then immediately you're out the top of the stairs in Cannes, and you're onto a beach party where Taron and Elton are singing I'm Still Standing, and you go, oh my God, this is amazing, and you know, Geffen is there, and Brian Lord and these incredible people from the industry are there on the beach sipping champagne saying, well, that's amazing, well done. What would you like to do next? And I was like, it's literally 2 hours after the film's sort of been shown. It's a roller coaster in terms of, you know, you dream for that, but then the reality of that dream becoming a waking dream is extraordinary.
And is it enjoyable?
Yeah, I think I made sure I enjoyed it, because I knew that there were elements of it that would be extremely stressful and would be very easy for me to not enjoy and just worry. But it doesn't do anything, you know. It's done. Yeah. And if I couldn't enjoy that moment, then I'd be really missing a trick. And you know, and it was a lot of fun being in the Carlton in Richard Madden's suite while we all drank champagne and vodka and various other drinks till 2 a.m, and then going to my room next door and just hearing him and all his mates carrying on partying, and I was like, well, that's as it should be, that's great.
Yeah.
And And there was something really sort of satisfying, and I felt like I'd done something for them and me, everyone involved, which is really a nice feeling. And but then I did wake up the next morning and go, what have I done? Where am I? How comes I'm in the cult? And my wife just laughed at me. Because, it was kind of overwhelming.
But fun.
Definitely fun.
So, because again, you've not been through this part of the process either before. Because we're in the point now where Paramount is clearly so happy with the film, they're endlessly pushing it into the awards conversation, which is what's brought us into this room here today. Yeah, there's no point not acknowledging.
No, it's true.
What's this bit like? Because you've done one press tour.
I have,
and
yeah.
Are you getting exactly the same questions you were... I might have just asked you exactly the same questions.
No, I always endeavour to respond in the most original way that I can, or honest way that I can. But, I mean, it's inevitable that you come over the same answers on certain things, and there's a soundbite that you get and you go, well, this fills that kind of gap or gives some sort of idea of what that's like. But every interview is different. Everyone wants to know sort of different things, and you've got to be able to respond accordingly, I think. I mean, I think, look, it's interesting and it's still exciting to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
And that is something that, you know, coming out in May and still being in the conversation in November...
Yeah. You're like the Silence of the Lambs.
Why is that what happened with that?
Yeah. People still talking about it, eight months on.
Yeah, I mean, that in itself is a win, if you know what I mean, or is a huge accolade. And because, you know, there's a theory, you know, you come out in October and then you're in the awards slot and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we'll come out in May and because of the Elton element of it in Cannes, we wanted to be at Cannes. It felt like the right place for it, and it's close to Elton's home. And and you go, okay, well then we're not going to be in that conversation, but that's fine because there will be so many films that have come out by then, and Joker and Marriage Story and blah blah blah. But here we are, and so that's like, well, okay, wow, great.
Well, there aren't sing-along screenings of Joker or Marriage Story.
Not yet. No, sing-along versions of The Irishman.
Yeah, that'd be a long album, wouldn't
it? Even shoot-along versions.
But you get a sense of the audience reaction to that people were pushing for sing-along screenings, which when you consider how dark the film goes at certain points.
I know.
Particularly that the Rocket Man sequence, which is extraordinary.
I know, that is extraordinary to me, and I've been to the start of one sing-along, and the first
What's
song...
What's your voice like? I mean, are you...
Mine?
Do you join in?
Oh, I'm fantastic.
Yeah.
I choose not to sing, it's unfair on others. But it's funny, because the first song is I Want Love.
Yes.
After The Bitch Is Back, the next thing that comes along is I Want Love, and it's a particular moment in the film that's quite, hopefully... revealing about the characters in a way that is quite sad.
Yes.
Because they're all saying, I want love and I don't have any. And that's not a jolly, upbeat kind of thing.
Yes.
And it's interesting to me because I'm like, wow, how does this play? How are people singing? Because at the end, you know, give you know, 500 miles, and it's all very upbeat and high, and it's got energy to it, but there's a lot of ballads in
Well, same as Sunshine on Leith, really, if we're...
They're more anthemic in a way, though. You know, Sunshine on Leith has become that big anthemic song at a football for that football team because it's that has that kind of feel to it. But it was interesting to hear I Want Love, and I don't think people sing along so much of that. But once Saturday Night's Alright for a Fight hits, it soars. And the musical is a unique beast in that if they're good, they really stand up to being revisited because the songs are great. People love that, and the sequences can work really well. I sat and watched La La Land again on the plane the other day, and I love it because I like those songs. I like City of Stars, you know, and I can sing along with that. But I enjoy that, and you know, there's sadness to that film as well, but it just works. I mean, it's the beauty of the musical. It's the oldest version of film, isn't it? You know, white sheet, projection, pianist. You know, that kind of notion that the music and the image together kind of marry really, really successfully. And so I think if it works, people want to go back to it.
Before I'm chucked out the room, if I can ask one more question. Mm. I appreciate there's lots of clickbaity stuff going around about what your next projects are going to be. Yeah. I'm just going to park that to the side, if that's all right. I'm just curious, where does all this leave you, this last year? I mean, the double success, really, of Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah. particularly Rocky Mountain, where does that leave you as a human being?
On a personal level?
Yeah.
It leaves me in a good place, I won't lie. You know, I've been at it for a long time. Since I was 6 years old, I could say I've dedicated my life to film and the industry one way or another, whether by accident or design. And after 40 years of being an actor, and that's a struggle, you know, even for
I was a Press Gang kid.
But and it's a great show. And after Press Gang, I had my years in the wilderness, you know. Until Lock Stock came around again, but in that respect, it's very rewarding that I managed to write something that people responded to, and now I have a sort of second career, as it were, which I love, and that's exciting. I find it overwhelming and daunting sometimes, but that's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah,
and I think there's a lot more to come. I'm being offered some very interesting things, and I have a lot of challenges to rise to, so that's very exciting.
Dexter Fletcher, I wish you the best for the awards, and I wish you best for your future films. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you.
Rocket Man is available on DVD, Blu-ray, Ultra HD, 4K Blu-ray and digital download now, and is very much part of the award season conversation that's going on. Thank you again for all your support of these podcasts. You can find more from me at Simon Brew. You can find more from the entire Film Stories Project at Film Stories Pod. We have a whole host of video exclusive Film Stories episodes that you can find at youtube.com/filmstories. We're on Facebook as well, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. And that brings 2019 with Film Stories Podcasts to an end. Again, thank you so much for your support. If you're listening to this before Christmas, have a lovely Christmas. If you're not, have a lovely new year. If you're listening to this before Christmas and want a lovely new year as well, you have one of those too. The very best to you all. I'll be back soon with a new bunch and a whole new year's worth of film stories. Take care. Bye bye.